Welcome to Design Oracles. We are here to pontificate, evangelize, and educate you on residential interior design and architecture.
I'm Amity Worrell, interior designer of Amity Worrell & Company.
And I'm Diane Kett, architect of DK Studio, and together partners at Amity Kett.
Today we have Brad Whitman again, Builder Brad.
Glad to be back.
Yeah. Want to reintroduce yourself, Brad? I know you've been here before.
Sure. I'm Brad Whitman. I am co-owner and founder of LBR Homes in Austin, Texas.
And Brad is here talking with us again because he was so popular last time. And we work on a lot of projects together. And in our overarching theme for this season about how people of different disciplines in and around the interior and architecture field solve problems, Brad's going to wax poetic about how he tackles that. We would love to hear about that.
All right.
So Diane has written up some wonderful questions for you. Diane, you want to take it?
Okay, sure. Let's see. So as far as discipline goes, I mean, for you, it's about executing the design, right? And so there's probably a lot of challenges with that.
Yeah.
So you're often just handed this design, and then you got to go figure out how to put it all together.
Right.
In real three dimensions.
One of the things I've told you a lot through conversations what we do is my job as a builder in our firm is to basically understand y'all's language, right? We have to interpret that design to make it speak to our trade partners and our vendors and everybody that's going to be involved in building that project. So we have to understand and interpret the design more than anything else to be able to guide the execution of it.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard it put that way, but that's true. And I often say that, you know, our drawings are just a communication device. Mm-hmm. And so that's interesting. You're the bridge. You're the interpreter of the communication device.
I see it as us holding a paintbrush.
Yeah.
And we're painting a beautiful piece of art, right? And we have to pick the right brush and dip it in the right color and make that stroke at the right time and sequence everything to be able to bring it all together.
So how do you do that? So for instance, not us, but say somebody hands you a design that's not well thought out, or maybe just they don't have as much of an understanding, or maybe you're working directly with a client and they want something and not so much with a design professional. How do you help them interpret what it is that they want and how it will be built and what materials are appropriate, et cetera?
Well, where we've kind of progressed to within our company over the last 5-6 years is more so that we're not going to take on a project that doesn't have a full team involved anymore. There's so much additional bandwidth that needs to be had when it's only builder client in a design forward market, at least, that we just don't have the capability in-house to be able to lead that design. So we have to rely on a whole team effort of architects and designers and mechanical engineers and structural engineers and so on and so forth to be able to articulate that to the client. We get brought in typically by architects, but every so often we have a client that reaches out to us first, and we'll get an understanding of what their main goal is, and we'll sit down with them for a couple hours, maybe a couple times, and try to figure out what the relationship's going to look like, who we're going to be able to refer them to, who we think they're going to get along with the best, what their expectation of their project is, what their desires are, what their materiality standpoint is. So we can even gauge whether or not it's going to be a project that we're going to be capable of doing, not from a build standpoint, but from a relationship standpoint with that client. And so handling that in that sense is normally just part of that client interview process, and then not pushing them off, but guiding them towards the right person to do it, because that's just not our profession.
Yeah, there's that qualifying the client piece of it where you just make sure. And to that end, I agree with you. It's not about whether or not you're capable or they are like good people or that what they want is there's not. You want to make sure that they work with someone that can
that fits them
fit them, yeah, right?
I don't want to be a disservice to them.
Right.
That's why we don't handle things like that anymore either. Mm-hmm. Like I said, we don't have the bandwidth to do that. And so it would end up being a disservice for them when I need to focus heavier on construction.
So you talked about how you have a mechanical subcontractor you like to work with all the time, trim carpenters, maybe cabinets. So you've kind of gotten your team, and that's what I guess would be, because there's a lot of challenges and ease in mm-hmm. construction. So probably having that team is very helpful.
It helps. It's taken a long time to build a lot of those relationships. Mm-hmm. And the past couple of years, granted, have been trying on some of those relationships with how busy a lot of those trades are with other builders and stuff like that. So we're doing everything that we can to keep some of those guys intact. But at a certain point, it's also gotten to where we have to outsource to some other guys that we know, or, you know, or somebody that we've got to have as a referral from another builder friend to be able to get things done at a certain point in time. But yeah, we try to rely on the relationships that we have with the subcontractors, because those lasting relationships are particularly lasting because we've cultivated those into something where they understand what our expectations are, and not just from a communication standpoint and a timeline standpoint, but from a quality standpoint and understanding that where our head is from a client to as a representative of the client, they have begun to chase that as well, and they understand that they are not just putting Lego pieces together, that they have a crucial role in that project.
It's interesting. So what is the biggest challenge then? Because from what I see from my side, I think the job that a general contractor has to do is herd cats, you know, just make everybody, make everything line.
They're stray cats.
Make everything happen. Yeah. And to me, I think that would be the hardest thing, even in with good relationships, mm-hmm. because you can't control everybody's timeline exactly.
Oh, yeah, the scheduling.
Yeah, that seems like a huge challenge. And I will say, I'm always advocating on behalf of our builders for that relationship to the client, and reminding them how difficult the job is. So
right.
Tell us what you think the biggest challenge is.
In my career, side note, I think that there's, with these questions, there might be a lot of past versus now today, right? So in my career, I think the biggest challenge for the projects that we've always taken on would be to kind of train up the folks to see what our interpretation of your plans are. We'd get a lot of questions. Why do people want to build things this way? You know?
Oh, interesting.
And what's
oh my gosh,
what's,
that's fascinating.
What's the point of this? And yeah. And so we get to
why do they want to float the stair?
I have a feeling that he's protecting
exactly.
us in this conversation.
Exactly.
And that's not exactly how they word it.
No.
They throw it on the table and go, what the hell do these people think?
This is crap. Why do you want this? Mm-hmm. You're going to walk up the stair the same way. No. It's really, and that was kind of at the beginning of it, where we were, like I said, kind of training these guys up and getting folks to understand that that these designs are something to be proud of. And they give you an opportunity to hone your craft and do something different every time. The biggest challenge now is keeping people on site.
Definitely.
You know, we don't have, our trades aren't exclusive to us. They don't work with a lot of builders, but they're not exclusive to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you say you have 2, 3, 4 builders that you're working for, and then we've got 3 or 4 projects at a time going on, and those builders may have 1 to 3 to 5 projects at a time going on, with the logistics and the lead times and the lack of materials that we have right now, it's a more often than not right now we're hearing all of our trades saying, oh, well, this was late on this job, this was late on that job, this was late on this job. And now we have all these jobs to do at the same time, and we have to pick and choose who we're going to see first and who we're going to keep happy and who we're going to have to let go of from a relationship standpoint. And so now it's become such an employee's market that we're having to incentivize guys like nobody's business. And so the biggest challenge now for me is making sure that our homeowners have the same level of trust that they used to, and knowing that we're doing everything that we can in their best interest, more so than managing a project, it's making sure that they know we're doing the best that we can to manage that project with everything that's going on.
Yeah, I do find that to be very true too for my piece of my side of things, that I do find myself communicating to the clients that they're not alone in this, the difficulties that are happening now in the marketplace, and that everyone on this team is working on their behalf, and that if there are material costs that have gone up or lead times that have gotten longer, I feel as though I'm sort of a cheerleader for that. It's going to be okay. Just keep your eye on the ball.
Yeah, I want to get the job done just as much as they do.
Or more.
The longer it takes me to do it, the less money we make on our net at the end of the job.
Yeah, people never seem to understand that. Mm-mm, no. I always tell them that, but yeah.
I agree that that's a big challenge right now. And it's, you know, in this, it's hard to, I don't want to be too specific because this is not as though it's the only time it's happened in all of our careers, but it is uniquely complicated right now, I would say. And I think, to me, one of the things that we like about working with you is that we do know we can trust that you have everybody's best interest at heart.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. And so that when you have some bad news to tell us about a lead time or.
Yeah. I'll tell you, I may not have the answer yet, but as soon as I find out, you're going to know.
Right.
You just have to know that I'm going to find the answer.
Right.
I would say the building sequence is really hard right now. I mean, we had a project where the windows just kept delay.
Right.
And then, but what was amazing was how you came up with different ideas of how to keep the project going.
It's worked, and those delays put us 2 months behind schedule, and now we're 2 weeks ahead of schedule.
Are you serious? Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Yep.
So can we talk about that specific challenge? Because I would love to just circle back about that.
Sure.
Tell us, Brad, I'll set you up for this one, about our window challenge on the project we're working on and how you worked around that, because it was amazing.
So I'm not going to drop names on manufacturers. Don't. I don't think that's allowed.
Mm-mm.
Right?
No.
But we had a particular window package that we spent.
Well, there's some we love and some we don't love.
That's it. And the original package that we had was a package that we loved. We spent a lot of time selecting those windows, each particular window, the operation and function, the color, the type of glass, the hardware on them. And we're very excited about it. It's a very expensive window package. It's not, you know, a builder grade window package. And place the order at the beginning of the reconstruction phase after demo, which typically is very early. Got a 12 to 16 week lead time, which was okay. It was a little bit longer than what we expected from the original 8 to 10, but it was workable. Once we got up on the 12 week mark, we got a notification from the vendor of said window that they just received notification that the windows got pushed out to 21 weeks. So that was a conversation in and of itself to have and to kind of figure out resequencing things. We were still early enough on in the project with the foundation issues that we found on that and some of the scopes that we added to the sequence to maybe be able to counteract it. And then at 16 weeks, we got another notification that they were going out to 35 weeks. So at that point, we looked at other manufacturer options. Seemed like a great option. When we ordered them, they had their 16-week lead time, which was something that that particular manufacturer had gone to at the beginning of all these logistical issues, knowing that they were going to be coming. And then the vendor, it took the vendor about a week to get everything processed after payment and everything through the windows once we went through all the red lines.
The new window order.
And during that week, that new window manufacturer that we had switched over to and canceled the order of the other one had gone from 16 to 25 weeks in that week of processing. And so the biggest thing for us at that point was to figure out how to continue on with the house and how to properly dry it in and make it where these were going to end up being a retrofit window at that point, where we were basically going to remodel so we could still focus on our air barrier and our control layers.
Can I say something about this real quick for more clarity? Just because some people who are listening don't know quite as much about construction and the difference between, sorry, I won't let you go, but the difference between a window that you would put in on a renovation versus a new build. What you were just mentioning, it occurs to me that it needs a little bit of explanation.
Right. So a retrofit window or remodel window has no fins. The jamb sides are completely flat, and they're made to be able to slip into the frame. And there are different means of attachment and hanging that window.
And they do that because oftentimes when you're doing a renovation, you're not recladding the house and rebuilding the exterior walls.
That's right.
And so they have to be made differently, and takes a little bit more,
it's a little more invasive for new construction windows when you're dealing with the renovation, because you have that flange that needs to be sealed and taped and all of that. Yeah.
Great.
But we had new construction windows, and those were what was on order. So that create issues within our sequencing boundaries on the exteriors of the home and all of that. But we were able to get all the siding done. We ran the siding long to where we could then cut it out with a masonry grinder and just kind of figure it out. You know, it just brought challenges. One of the biggest things about the last couple of years of it, it's really taught us to figure new ways of doing things and not necessarily have, I think we're 2 years into it now, so the excuses are gone. Now it's more so just about making sure that you're communicating, because it's a new normal as of the last couple of years for these things to happen. And so I think it's really brought to light the level of communication that some particular folks have, or the lack thereof.
Sure. Yeah. And I think you probably are better, faster, stronger because of it in the end. The bionic man.
I think it's definitely helped us in the planning stage, because typically when we get a set of plans, like you mentioned earlier, one of the first things that we do is we build that house a few times on paper and on a budget. And we're realizing now that it's not necessarily going that way. The sequencing's different now because of logistics. Budget changes every day. And so we have new methods in place to be able to track certain orders. We have new processes in our CRM to be able to make sure that we're ordering things at a different phase now, and that we have separate notifications for calling and following up with vendors to make sure that that vendor is following up with their purchasing department, so their logistic time frames are getting fed back to us properly. Does it work? 50% of the time, no. We can't control everybody's job, but we're doing what we can on our end. Mm-hmm. And it has made a big difference.
Does it change the number of clients you can have at a time? Just curious.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I would think.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The amount of work that we have going on the back end now to manage a project is probably 20 to 40% more, depending on how design forward the project is and how involved we are with the logistics of certain aspects of it. And so it definitely, it makes a big difference in the office. More than anything else, time on the project for a small firm like us as well, managing the project and working with subcontractors. We have a lot more chair time and computer mm-hmm. time following up with things.
It's so interesting. Yeah. And a lot of builders don't have a good back end and it's hurt them, I think.
It does. It's if you try to stay, you know, we're a 4 to 6 project a year builder. We stay kind of low and slow and very heavily focused on our projects. We've cut back to the 3 to 5 range just so we can maintain that same level of focus for our clients. And what I was saying earlier is it does definitely affect the net on the bottom end when you slow down, but then those projects are taking even longer because of all of that. It's definitely a weird situation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of the way we work has changed. The way we talk about projects has changed.
Lots of Zoom calls.
A lot of time frame changes. A lot of early discussion around budget.
Right.
It's. I think it's these challenges and this problem solving that we're all doing is in the end going to make us just better at.
I don't think it's a bad thing. I mm-hmm. think that it's just different for us, and we're in a transitional time for our industry. And I think the ones that are going to make it or break it are going to be the ones that learn from it and figure out how to move forward and quit using it as an excuse.
Yeah, so, I agree. Yeah.
So when you talked about how you make a house, you were making it more airtight while we're going and putting the windows in. So you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, what does dry in mean? And
not necessarily dry in, but practice that Brad does that a lot of builders don't do is kind of condition the space. And tell us why you do that.
Well, especially for a house that's at that level of interior finish, we want to make sure that our indoor air quality and our air conditioning and our air scrubbing and our air quality in general through construction is going to be as close to what we can feasibly and financially maintain as what the house is going to be post-construction. That's when your finishes are going in. We want them to start being acclimated to what normal everyday life is going to be during construction. We want to spoil the subcontractors and make sure that they have a reason to come back to that job site because it feels good in there in July in Texas. Not really, but
it works though. We spend more time on that.
It definitely does work. Our site meetings are a blast.
Yeah.
It's so with those windows being out, that house was a particular challenge because it's a, 1930s kind of cottage that already had an addition done. The original scope was not a full exterior. There are building practices that are not necessarily what we focus on from a just CDX and Tyvek and shingling and so on and so forth. But with respect to budgets, there's certain things that we can and can't do. And we had a lot that we had to do on that project already. And so one of the things that we focused real heavily on was a product called Aero Barrier. And a good buddy of mine and his father owned that branch of Aero Barrier in Austin. And we focus as heavily as we can on air sealing our control layers in the field and getting to the tightest point that we can from a blower door. It's a system that goes on to the door and creates a positive environment in the home to, basically act like wind blowing on the home at all directions. Right. Kind of an easy way to describe it for more people to understand it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so we'll come in, do an initial blower door test, find what the leakiness of the structure is, and then we try to detail it as best we can. When we have a house that is a 1930s home and we can't rip everything off and just take it all the way to the studs and put new sheathing and maybe zip system or Alumiflash or something like that on it, we'll have them come in and they use this atomized caulking, basically, and pressurize the home instead of doing a negative pressure on it during a blower door to find what that internal leak is, they pressurize it. So all of those little orifices throughout the structure will take the path of least resistance, basically. And that atomized caulking goes to all those little holes, and in time it builds up and it seals it.
And so this is all before we've got drywall and everything.
This
like
is
that.
Prior to insulation and everything. Yeah,
right.
We want to focus on air sealing before insulation. A lot of folks want to use insulation as an air seal. You can do that if you have a closed cell spray foam. But when you're using bibs or rock wool or even open cell spray foam, none of that's good for an air seal. Rock wool is a great product from an antimicrobial and hydrostatic hydrostatic properties and stuff like that. But for air sealing, none of those are any good for that. So if you can focus heavily on your envelope prior to insulation, that's where you're going to see the best results for sure. And so we wanted to do that before windows came in. So we used zip sheathing to temp in our windows and then sealed up around those with a closed cell spray foam, just a gap filler and some tape. Basically left our window trim on the exterior off, ran our siding long, and was able to continue on with the house. And even with the plywood on the windows, before windows came in, we got, oh gosh, what did we do? I think we got down to a .9 ACH 50 on the blower door. Once windows finally came in, we were able to detail everything. And right before insulation, after the aero barrier, after windows went in, we got the house down to a 0.41 ACH 50 rating, which is below passive house levels. We're very proud of that for a 1930s pier and beam structure.
Absolutely.
It's pretty awesome.
And then what does that do for when you're putting in all the interior finishes later? You said we had a lot of expensive finishes and we wanted...
Well, I can say something about that.
A more stable environment.
Because I've had other projects where there have been issues, which I'll speak of without naming them, where the floors, there were some existing wood floors, mm-hmm. and they were covered in the AC wasn't properly running and things were not conditioned properly and the floors warped.
Right.
And the entire floor had to be ripped out of the house and replaced, even though that wasn't on the original agenda.
Right.
There are some issues sometimes with tile that is handmade,
mm-hmm.
Leaching.
Right.
Because the air condition is not what it will be when someone is living in the home. It isn't managed. And so then the tiles are go in, and then because of the heat and the moisture, the humidity, leach salt up through the
right.
tile
right.
that has been made, and it leaves marks that can't be taken off.
To that point, too, climatization is a big deal. You can bring material into the home and let it sit uninstalled in a 80-degree and 75% humid climate. And it's going to go in and it's going to be just fine. As soon as you go in and you turn over that home and you crank that AC up and it sucks everything down to, 72, 68 degrees, whatever people are comfortable with, especially if there's no dehumidification or anything like that, you have this shock on the material. And when that material is set in place with some sort of a cementitious backer, or adhesive, or it's screwed in, or whatever, that's when you start seeing these dissimilar materials have issues between each other. And so maintaining some sort of acclimatization during construction after that closed dry-in phase when you get ready to start those finishes is huge.
It is.
So a lot of times builders will wait till the AC is actually turned on, and then they come in and climatize the wood floors and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But you do all this so that it's all much earlier on than that, so all the wood studs have
yes.
got all their moisture taken out,
that's right.
the subfloor, everything. So it's more than just, we
start
having
doing
the finishes climatized. You're getting all the base that everything is getting putting onto. Perfect.
Right. Yeah, we don't have drywall cracks. We don't have warranty calls for drywall cracks for mm-hmm. that reason.
And what made you think you should do that?
Our climate.
Your brain.
Was it just studying it or studying construction practices over the years?
I think it might be, yes, a part of it would be studying some of that, but more of it is being in construction. Some of the companies that I work for, some of the warranty calls that I got for just stupid reasons to fix mm-hmm. things, and the things that can be counteracted a little bit earlier on in the process. If we can absorb $2,000-$3,000 maybe in a $1.5 million project to save ourselves, $5,000-$10,000 worth of warranty work after the homeowner's in there, save the discomfort of being in there and moving all their furniture mm-hmm. around after the fact.
Being annoyed that there's
Why would they not be okay with doing that?
Mm-hmm.
We're already most of the time putting temp AC in these homes at a certain phase. Just do it a little sooner.
Yeah, it's frustrating for the clients. It's unhappiness. It's expensive for you
right.
and loss of money.
Right.
So it helps the bottom line. It right. helps the client as well. And
the thing that drives
happier.
Me the craziest is driving by some of these homes that that have stucco lath going up, but all the windows are open, and you see guys in there floating sheetrock, and or painting the house, and doors are hung and stuff like that. And it's like, man, you guys are going to have a hell of a time. So, but you mm-hmm. but you have that with production builders. You put a warranty list together before the end of the year, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they come in and they'll do whatever they can to...
There's different ways to manage it. There's a right and wrong or just a...
Yeah, I don't know if there's necessarily a right and a wrong. I think it's a different perspective.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think that's true. So, interesting.
And then, I guess once we are finishing up a project, then do you do the blower test again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do a final blower test before mm-hmm. we turn everything over. Without windows taped up, without exhaust fans and stuff like that taped up, where we're not trying to find these holes and these leaks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So you can hand over a really great house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This particular project that we keep referencing has some challenges. I mean, there's some very precious and delicate finishes going into it eventually. Some wall treatments that need to be very precise and are laid out very carefully, are not inexpensive. How do you go about preparing for that? I mean, I know you and I had some conversations talking about just the entrance hall and how all of these materials, a ceiling, paper, tile,
mm-hmm.
a wall panel detail, and a wallpaper that's a grass cloth, all coming together in that same spot. So what was your preparation for that?
Making sure that you guys are happy with how it comes together.
And how did you do that? You had to draw it out on the wall, for instance.
Yeah, we do a lot of mock-ups. We're very – I'm a very visual person, and so for me it helps a lot. And I've learned over the years that somehow it makes the clients become very visual. Even early on, Diane's there when I do little doodles on the fireplace and stuff like that. Try to make these like quick sketch 3D renderings and give them a better visual of things. And so we will mock up trim layouts down to the 16th of an inch to be able to make sure that particular details are laid out in person so you can see the big picture. We'll make tables and make light fixtures and islands and make sure that the space feels right and so on and so forth. And so when it comes to things like wallpaper and trim details and all of those coming together, the trim details are going to make the biggest difference on seaming everything. The wallpaper's tricky.
It is.
It's tricky mm-hmm. because sometimes it's going to be up to the installer to be able to tell where the sequencing of the paper is going to land,
mm-hmm.
Which paper needs to go up first to overlap the next paper. If it's a grass cloth, it's mm-hmm. going to fray and so on and so forth.
Exactly.
And, mm-hmm. and so I think it all just comes down to communicating as best we can, whether it's by words or visuals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think
I probably didn't answer anything that you asked.
No, you did. No, so. That's exactly right. It's the importance of, for instance, furniture layout. So you mentioned building a table. There was a moment where we're doing a custom light fixture, and to be able to adequately size that and order it and have it be correct when it comes in months in advance, mm-hmm. we have to have a mock-up of a dining table at the correct height so we can place the light fixture in the ceiling at the right location.
Well, and it's not even just
and
timing.
Get the drop. Right.
It's not even just timing. That's an expensive miss.
Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah. So it's one of those things I was bringing up, and Diane brought up the finishes too, is just all of this hard work we do to make the space airtight and comfortable and well-constructed and quiet and sound control and is all great. The icing on that cake is the finishes. So the last person in, it gets the sort of the blame and the credit a lot of times. And so whether that's fair or not, that's why it has to be thought through from literally the ground up and each of those little moments. So for instance, in this entrance hall where there'll be a panel detail that's going to be painted, a ceiling detail where there's a drop and receiving a certain paper. If, for instance, all your hard work
and
is
then
for
all
not,
the walls around it is another paper joining up to all of that.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's very complicated. And if it isn't thought through in advance in that construction phase, we may need to, change. Not, this is an exaggeration. It's not exactly right. But like change a wall frame out even sometimes so that it comes a little further forward so that a trim edge can die at the right spot so that we can get the paper there. But if you didn't know the paper was going in, you need to know all those finishes
absolutely
from when you begin.
Right.
That's why it's important. This is my giving a lesson to everyone that all those finishes get chosen and decided early on in the process.
Right. Yeah, so they don't look like an afterthought.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And then there's space for them to be applied, and the intricacies of that application are thought through in the build-out and the trim-out.
So, agreed.
Yeah. Just a little soapbox there.
So I know you work really closely with the homeowners on all the projects, usually talking to them almost every day, if not more than once a day, right?
Yes.
So how, when you end it, you're not talking with them anymore. How does that go?
You know, that's been a weird thing over the last few years. There's not very many homeowners that we don't still talk to, at least on a weekly or monthly basis. Everybody's almost become friends. They're not acquaintances or clients anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I have more past homeowners reach out and just ask how I'm doing than friends do. in my industry, and as entrenched in the industry as we are, the most that you hear from people that you've known for a long time is, "Hey, I need this. Where do I go?"
Mm-hmm.
Right? Or, "Hey, how do I do this?" Or whatever. Homeowners reach out and, "Hey, what are you guys doing this weekend? Y'all want to come to a barbecue?" Or, you know, stuff like that. And so it's been great. And we've got projects that we miss the clients because it does become such a positive interaction through the process, and it becomes such an emotional relationship. And especially over the past couple of years, that relationship has become even more emotional because of all of the, we have to be such a bearer of bad news, right? And how we've had to navigate relaying that information to folks has been something that we've had to learn very well from a psychological standpoint, almost.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's done really well. I think it's been able to generate a lot of trust with clients and make those friendships. And so, there's probably one or two folks that we've worked with in the past 5 years that we don't talk to anymore. And I'm happy for that because those were just folks that we didn't like.
Good. They're not a good fit. They weren't a good match.
Mm-hmm. And that's okay. That's part of growing mm-hmm. and learning a business, right? But yeah, I don't know that there's very many that we don't talk to anymore.
It's
kind of nice.
It's always weird for me when I'm seeing them every week and we're discussing all of our live events, and then all of a sudden I don't see them every week anymore.
Well, and I miss the process sometimes with said client and so on and so forth. But we're so busy with the rest of them
mm-hmm.
that they don't blend into each other. It changes, the relationship changes, but the general process kind of stays the same. So it's an easier transition. And as we've grown, we've learned to vet clients a little bit better and make sure that we're chasing that particular type of relationship. So it's not so emotional to not be mm-hmm. in, you know, weekly and mm-hmm. daily interacting with the previous clients.
So important. Diane and I even had a podcast about this, about how that relationship with clients and not always having it go perfectly smoothly isn't necessarily, it's good for relationships sometimes. Like
right.
you talk about delivering bad news.
Right.
Because I think we see when we make everything look really easy that people don't understand the intricacies. And this has been an opportunity for people to understand that it isn't always easy, that there are difficult things. And
right.
then they understand because you deliver the news to them in a way that helps the project move forward. You're problem solving, you're honest, you're upfront, you're telling them early on, they kind of get to go along for the ride a little bit more, and
yeah.
it builds a deep connection and a deep relationship. It sounds like we're talking about something very different than what we're talking about, really, than we're sitting here talking about being, you know, doing custom homes, but it is a very emotional process. It's where people live. It's, you know, and like you say, you talk to them every day. This is
right.
the people you're going to be having coffee with in the mornings. And so it's a really rewarding thing.
It absolutely is.
Those relationships. It's a gift.
It absolutely is.
Mm-hmm.
So
sure.
we recently had finished a house, or a couple months ago now, I guess, and we were designing and planning for future dog and future cat, and we got a picture like last week of
yep.
future dog.
Yep.
I never found out that they name him Future.
Did they name him Future?
I don't know. I had asked, but I didn't find out.
We need
out.
To find that out.
Yeah,
we built a doggy gate and all sorts
for
of stuff.
Dog.
It
for
wasn't
future dog.
Just a doggy gate.
No, that was a very significant gate. we designed this rolling gate to match the kind of craftsman style wood handrails that we had fabricated out of steel, and a recessed track built into the deck
mm-hmm.
and a guide system and rollers. So when this thing's shut, it looks like the handrails
future
on the rest of the porch.
Future dog was still in there.
Yep, exactly. So
function and beauty.
It is. It actually worked out really cool. That was one of those off the whim, "Hey, why don't we do this?" crazy Brad ideas. And everybody
and
was
like, all about it.
Well, at first y'all were like, "What?"
I was trying
then,
to follow it in my head.
and then we drew out a rendering of it, and it happened, and it turned out mm-hmm. really cool. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. That was fun.
So what would you say is one of your most successful projects? Or how do you determine your most successful project?
I think success comes in three different forms on mm-hmm. a project, right? You've got your budget, you've got your timing, but then you've got that relationship. You can be on time and under budget and only focus on that and not really worry about the relationship. I don't think that proves successful. I think success to me means more so clients maybe leaving a review or telling their friends, or, you know, we don't do any advertising or mm-hmm. anything like that. And so one of the projects that we worked on together, all of us on Lake Austin, mm-hmm. I think would be, in a sense, the closing of that project was right after COVID hit and we started getting some of the logistical issues. We ended up 3 months behind schedule mm-hmm. when we could have been much further behind schedule.
We also had the snowpocalypse in there.
We did. We had a lot. We had a lot that happened. And considering all of that, we stood outside and we popped champagne and we all cried together mm-hmm. and talked about how that was, you know, that the clients didn't think that they'd ever live in a home like that. Probably the most technologically advanced home we've ever done. Probably the most design-forward home we've ever done. Mm-hmm. Probably the best view of any home we've ever built. So we're definitely the one that we're most proud of, I think. And we've had a lot of work come from referrals from those clients. We're building another house for friends of theirs. Mm. Right now we did another large project for another friend of theirs that just won an award in the Austin Home Design Awards. And so I think that's transferred a lot to, it's transferred a lot to our career. And I'd say that probably lends the most success is we're great friends with those clients still. We talk every single week. We talk about their vacation that they're on right now and all of that. And we've become great friends with their referrals as well. So I think that's probably the best one. And then we've got one that we're working on right now that is significantly under budget and 2.5 months ahead of schedule.
And wow.
Yep.
It's incredible.
For this day and age, it definitely is.
It's not a project I'm on.
It's been, it's not, it's not. It'd be over if you were. We know that. No.
Thanks.
That's a bad dig.
It's okay.
Overly beautiful, too.
Exactly. Thank you.
It is. It's for somebody that you know, though.
Yes. And, I do know the project. That's great to hear.
It's mm-hmm. an amazing project, an amazing couple. Really, really awesome build.
Enthusiastic and fun, right?
Very much so. Mm-hmm. It was going to be a 13-month build. We had some issues with the city, with the taps department up front, and ended up pushing us all the way until September of last year to start this project. And we're going to be closing it out in about a month now. So we're significantly ahead of schedule. We've got some issues right now with the right-of-way department that's not going to help us achieve our turnover date at the end of this month, which really sucks. But we're still ahead of schedule and under budget, and we've got a great relationship with them as well. And it's been that's going to be one of those projects that we'll miss the process, I think,
sure.
because it's just mm-hmm. it's been so fun. So yeah, two main ones, but I think our most successful and most fun was probably the big one that we did together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's great.
I can't say addresses.
No addresses.
All right. Well, I don't know. Is there anything else you want to say?
Anything else you want to share?
From a discipline standpoint,
mm-hmm.
I think the biggest thing, if we can leave here with me kind of speaking some advice mm-hmm. more than anything else, if we have more homeowners than anything else that listen to this from a design standpoint and looking for a small piece of advice, it doesn't necessarily come down to somebody being disciplined, right? We made a joke about this the other day on the phone, Diane.
Mm-hmm.
I think finding somebody that works best for you and for your team within that respective discipline for the project, right? I'm a builder, that's my discipline. You're an architect, that's your discipline. She's a designer, that's her discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And so on and so forth. I really do think it comes down to the relationship more than anything else within the project. I've said it 1,000 times. There's many, many, many great builders out there. There really are. It doesn't mean you're going to work great with all of them. It doesn't mean you're going to work great with me. We may not get along. That's fine. I have no problem referring folks to somebody else to make sure that they're in the best hands. So when it comes to that discipline, make sure that you are going to fit best with the person that is executing that discipline of your project.
That is great. That is a perfect way to finish it. I underlined as you were talking, relationship, discipline, find your match, and then it's all about that relationship. So thank you.
Well, thank wonderful. Y'all for having me again.
Thanks for being here.
I appreciate it.
Thanks, Brad.
All right.
Woohoo.
See you guys.
Thank you for listening to Design Oracles with Amity Worrell, owner of Amity Worrell & Company, and Diane Kett, owner of DK Studio, and together, partners at Amity Kett.